What's going on, everybody? It's Chaz, your host of the DSPAC podcast. I'm fired up to talk to you about the SPAC conference. If you are considering going public, using a SPAC as a vehicle to do so, this is a must-attend event. Find out more information at thespacconference.com. I will be speaking there along with an ocean of other heavy hitters in the SPAC and DSPAC ecosystem. It's June 9th and 10th. At the Westchester Country Club in New York. Don't miss it. What's going on, everybody? It's Chaz, your host of the DSPAC podcast. I am here with the CEO of All Things Good in New York. I just absolutely love this guy. You're going to find this is Roshan with Stardust Power. He took his company public through a SPAC. We're hitting you from a totally different angle. You're a private company looking to go public. You want to know what it's like if you go through a DSPAC process. This is your time to listen. So pay attention to what Roshan has to say. He's kind, he's brilliant, and he's got experience. Those gray hairs aren't just because he's the most compelling and charismatic man in the world and you need to buy a cerveza from him. So just pay attention to what this guy has to say as we dive in. Roshan, how you doing, brother?
Great. Thanks for having me on, Chaz. I'll do my best to live up to that.
It won't be hard. And if you guys don't have the privilege of knowing Roshan, the first time that he and I really sat down and talked to each other, he's just so, you know, some people are just so easy to talk to. Roshan, you are one of those people, man, to where just, I feel like people naturally, when they give you the opportunity to talk to you, they just naturally feel comfortable around you. And I just want to celebrate you for that. It's a rare and beautiful trait for you to be able to do so. So with that said, start off by just telling us a little bit about you and Stardust.
Yeah, happy to, and just really excited to be on the DSPAC podcast. I wish this had existed before our process. It's great that you're filling in, you know, the information that needs to be happened. So, you know, my background is a bit unique. I, you know, am the CEO of a boutique financial services company, Vikasa Capital. So had a lot of exposure to the industry, but then founded Stardust Power. And we had a very unique problem. How do you raise a bunch of pre-FID capital, so pre-construction capital for these large capital intensive lithium refining projects? So we saw the best opportunity to tap the capital markets and be able to leverage those to for the enormous capitalization required. And we were largely successful to do that. We were able to raise a lot of money to get us to the shovel ready state.
I love that. Keep going.
Yeah. And you know, when we went public and when we started the DSPAC process, it was during a very challenging time in the market. You know, the markets were volatile. The election was happening. You know, we started our process in the summer of 24, the election being in November, and the markets kind of froze. You know, a lot of people weren't doing deals before him. A lot of people weren't doing deals right after, as everyone wanted to rebalance and see the changes in the new administration. And then a lot of changes from the regulatory front, the, you know, changing of the Inflation Reduction Act, which removed the $7,500 tax credit from the EVs, created a lot more volatility in the market. Now, President Trump has been amazing for critical minerals, and he's been one of the most proactive administrations. So there's been a lot of long-term support, but it took us a while to kind of get our bearings. So, you know, we came public in July of 2024 and, you know, there was a lot of wait and see. So, you know, what I think was important is that we had a strong plan for what we wanted to do and the reasons why we wanted to go public, especially via SPAC.
I love that you said that, like the wait and see, because I feel like a lot of companies that come out the gate, they do the DSPAC, And they just kind of, they expect just a pageantry that everybody else is excited about their company as they are to be public. Their attorney told them that they're pretty. Their investment banker told them that they're pretty. You know, the auditor says that they're pretty. Why would anybody be lying to them? You know, like everyone's going to think that we're a beautiful company and they're all going to give us our money and our stock's just going to soar. And the reality is that you're unproven whenever you come out, like, and they want to see how you're going to perform. So I really love that you took that wait and see mentality and you came into it eyes wide open.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things you maybe aren't told in the very beginning. You're so focused on the transaction itself, but that preparation for being a public company is really, you know, maybe the most important part of it, as the de-SPAC is just the beginning of a journey, really. So some of the things to consider are who your strategic partners are. You know, one is that alignment with the sponsor is so important. You know, they control a bunch of shares. They control a lot of decision-making in the de-SPAC process. They can potentially have board representation. So the right sponsor is so important. Do they believe in the company? Do they believe in the long-term success of the company? Are they just trying to get a deal done? Are they just trying to return liquidity as much as possible? And, you know, you never know with certain sponsors. So really having that alignment from the get-go and how you structure the deal and how you live as a public company is important. And another thing that's so important is managing costs during the de-SPAC. Typically, the surviving entity pays for the transaction cost and maybe even some accumulated cost of the SPAC sponsor. Yeah. So we have to make sure that both parties are aligned to keep cost efficient. Otherwise, you have a new public company that's saddled potentially with a lot of payables and or debt, which makes it a tough go from the outgo. And sometimes these sponsors, you know, are not aligned to keep costs down because it's not on their dime and they can build relationships, they can do other things. So strong alignment with them is really important. And then other strategic partners as the right bankers. You know, typically their new companies are going to have to raise some money in the near term, and finding the right banking partners can be a challenge as a new de-SPAC, as a non-Rule 144 eligible company. So having the right bankers and the right strategic partners from the get-go is important. And that really includes legal as well, having the right advisors that can be efficient.
Do me a favor, unpack real quick, why? Like, why does it matter? Like, from your perspective, what did you experience to where you realized it's different if I use this banker versus that banker? Obviously, we're not throwing people under the bus, anything like that. But speaking ambiguously and generally, like, what do you think that these private companies should be looking at when they're engaging a banker from their side? And why do they need a banker from their side?
Yeah, it's a tough choice to pick the right bank. You know, depending on market size and the interest of institutional investor, a lot of recent de-SPACs are not going to get bulge bracket banks. And maybe if they have good institutional investor support already on their cap table or they're in a sector, but, you know, there's so much volatility around the de-SPAC that often you're not going to get the bulge bracket right beginning. And you'll have to look at second and maybe third tier banks. And some of these banks have, you know, different ways of doing business. You know, picking the right investors for those opportunities are really important. Some banks act as equity capital market desks for, you know, large hedge funds in essence. So you really have to be careful who the bank is and what type of investors they're going to bring on. Because, you know, in New York or the market, some funds will invest just to short your stock even. You think they're really excited about giving you all this money, but they're really doing it to short your stock. So finding the right long-term partners, even from investors and bankers, is really important.
Yeah, and you've got a special someone down in Puerto Rico who will call you up and say, hey, I'm your largest rights holder, and I've just got a few questions for you. All the while, he's the guy that's been crushing you and shorting you, right? So...
you know, another interesting thing that some people might not tell you is there's this period of insecurity, I'll say, prior to issuing your S1, you know, after you did the de-SPAC, you do it through an S4, then you have to release the initial S1. Yeah. But there is this window where potentially warrant redemptions can come in that you're not being able to honor. So we had, you know, people calling us up asking about these warrants, and if we would have said the wrong answer, could have invited a lawsuit. So there's a lot of dangers in that de-SPAC period too. And those warrant holders, you know, are important to be aligned as well.
And that's one of those things to where it's like tale as old of time. You don't know the answer. So if you don't know the answer, say, that's a great question. Let me find out about that for you. And then you go talk to your attorney and your TA, you know, and like, and get the real story. But yeah. So let me ask you this. One thing, whenever you talked about the eyes wide open kind of thing, how concerned with you were you about share price whenever you guys came out?
You know, I'll admit it. I was too concerned about share price. When we de-SPAC'd, we were trading around a market capitalization of $500 million, and we were a very young company. And I sincerely believe that's the value of the company. Now it should be even more considering we've moved our project along. And we traded very well for the first 4 or 5 months. And, you know, we were very concerned. You know, we really should have been less concerned about share price and more concerned about capitalization. In the initial days of a SPAC, there's always some volatility. And what we see is there's even these days where you had these tremendous price spikes. You know, I was a billionaire for overnight one period. So it's nice to cross that off the list. But, you know, even though it was grounded in whatever it was, leveraging those times to raise capital and leverage those spikes, being prepared for those spikes. So, you know, what I really urge is it's a long journey. The share price of the first 4 months, you know, tracking it every day as new sponsors or, you know, new companies will do, but really focus on capitalization from the right sources. And that's a recipe for long-term success.
Man, that is so well said. Like, because, and here's the thing. Tell me this. Did you have people in your ear that were telling you that you needed to be sweating that stock price and basically pushing your attention back to it and giving a hard time about it? First of all, I'd love to know that.
You know, not really. We were really lucky that our private company investors were well aligned, and you know, they had produced so much wealth. You know, we were tracking, we call it the houses that Stardust built, because so many people were going out and buying new homes because of the tremendous wealth. So our investors, even through the volatility, I think returned out nice. But as a new issuer, I think we were pretty concerned about that and really maybe less willing to sell shares into the market if we thought it could lower our price. Inevitably, the first deal we did as a public company was a short-term debt deal that, you know, maybe wasn't the best deal, but it solved a short-term need, and that impacted the stock price more than anything. And then we had to do multiple S1 raises prior to being S3 eligible. And, you know, doing multiple raises in a short time was a difficult period for us and created a lot of volatility. But at the end of the day, we got to this position of being a shovel-ready lithium project. It's taken us $45 million-ish to get there, which is a pretty reasonable amount of money, but we're able to do that in a really short time. Our mantra has always been speed to market. Let's get this refinery built as fast as possible.
It's so interesting. Like, a lot of times companies think, we did it. We rung the bell. We de-SPAC'd. We're public. And they look at it as the finish line when the truth of the matter is it's the starting line, you know, and so you had challenges dealing with the S1s, everything like that, trying to even get to being able to have the shelf registry. And so let me ask, what other complications do you feel that you kind of ran up against unexpectedly? You're public and you kind of got blindsided by something.
Yeah, you know, I think it was the form in which we had to raise money. We were able to raise a really strong pipe, $12 million in pure common equity with no warrant exposure. But I think the cost of the de-SPAC escalated so much that we could have utilized that pipe to take us all the way to Rule 144 eligibility, which is 365 days afterwards. But we were burdened with so many transaction costs that we had to go and raise money over and over again. So I think a good rule is to, you know, really have a strong plan of capitalization through Rule 144 which is roughly the same time you can be shelf eligible as well. S1 open offerings can have a significant impact on the share price, and doing multiples of those was challenging.
Yeah, I know that whenever, because you talk about just these expenditures, and they can be, depending on the SPAC team you do a deal with and how their stuff was structured. For a SPAC team, obviously their biggest cost is underwriters, traditionally, you know, and there's an upfront cost. Like if you're a private company looking to go in public, and you may not know this about how it works for the SPAC team and how it could impact you on the backside, but these SPAC teams, they have their upfront cost to do the IPO. And then a lot of time there's shares, rep shares that go into the deal. But then further to that point, there's what's called deferred compensation. And this deferred compensation on the backside is what can be impactful for the private company, because a lot of times that money is coming out of trust or coming out of proceeds from somewhere. And it could be one of those things to where you may think, oh, we're going to walk away from this with $50 million. And then the underwriter is not like, no, actually, here's our agreement. We actually get this amount of money and it's a few million bucks. And you're just like, oh, so it's all of a sudden 3% of the $150 million, of the deal, you know, or something like that. And it can be a lot when it doesn't get contended with. And that's not even including other variables like deferred compensation for the attorney, deferred compensation for the auditors. Then you as a private company, what other costs were you picking up? Because I know with every SPAC team, it can be different. Did you pick up IR, PR, things of that nature? Pay the DSPAC, or did you pay the tail policy for the SPAC team for their D&O insurance?
Yeah, so we definitely had to, you know, pick up the insurance policy, including the tail. That's, I think, pretty standard in any transaction because you're the surviving entity. So that one's hard to fight back on. We chose to do all the IR and PR so we could control it. We can control cost. I think that was a cost well served. We were very efficient and we got a lot of good publicity from that. Those legal fees can be a lot. You know, the SPAC sponsor can run up a lot of legal fees, calling it due diligence as a CYA. But, you know, how much you decide how much you need to do of that. And then you're paying for both sides. You're paying two legal teams to argue each other and you're picking up the same bill. So alignment can be challenging there. Printing can be a substantial cost in a $1 billion transaction. You know, no one's going to think about a $1 million printing fee, but for a smaller transaction, you know, that can be a lot. And there's a lot of optionality in that now. And then, as you mentioned, the banking fees, the capital market advisory fees, and then deferred fees that the SPAC might have been running in their search for other targets as well. So you really have to be thoughtful on looking at what those deferred costs are, potentially capping them or creating payment plans over a period of time, and not having so many bills hit the day of listing, which can be challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it is a capital intensive thing just to do the DSPAC. But, and further to that point, you specifically are in a crazy capital intensive industry. Projects for lithium refineries are, I just have to imagine, just insane for how much it cost to hit that inflection point to where you can start printing money out of it. Am I wrong?
No, it's an expensive industry. You know, we recently released that the CapEx requirement alone for our phase one is $500 million. And that's just from a CapEx perspective. So if you throw insurance payments and some other costs, it, you know, can be substantially above that. So it is a very capital intensive industry. You know, we've been talking a lot about the challenges and the expenses of a DSPAC and the volatility that can happen with it. But I still think it's a great tool.
Absolutely.
And a great process. If you go into it eyes open and you have a plan, even though we've suffered a lot of volatility in our share price, the fact that we have gone from a newly incorporated company in just 2023 to a shovel-ready national infrastructure project in 2026 is amazing, if I can say so myself. So you know, there's been a lot of challenges. There's been a lot of gray hairs and sleepless nights, but I'm really excited of where we are now. And I think the SPAC can be a great vehicle.
So I agree with you 100%. And I mean, man, the fact that, just to your point, the fact that in 3 years you've been able to execute what you have, you couldn't have done that through a traditional IPO process. It just wasn't, it wasn't viable. But yet you were able to go out, get the capital you need, position yourself to secure more capital, to be able to do corporate financing, project level financing, and really be able to get things going at a clip that would have taken you, if you didn't do that, an extra 10 years, probably.
I mean, it could have taken a long time. I don't think we'd be where we are today if we weren't able to tap the capital market.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's think about this real quick. How has your thinking evolved around dilution, debt, strategic capital since you've gone public?
Yeah. So, you know, I think we were in a very unique place that we were able to move our company forward as a private company swiftly and efficiently. That I was pretty chunky when we became a public company. So I understood that I would get diluted. But as long as we were moving our objectives forward, I was very happy because what we're building is so valuable. So, you know, last summer, lithium prices cratered to $5,000 a ton-ish. They've rebounded today to $28,500-ish.
Wow.
But we had to sell shares at the nadir of the lithium market at, you know, 20 cents or something like that. Even though it was a very dilutive event and a challenging one, it still kind of pushed us over to this shovel-ready state. So I think what's most important is if you believe in what your company, you can't worry about dilution on every transaction. You know, the right type of debt can be valuable, debt that won't cripple you, the right type of debt investor, especially because you'll get all types of options. There were, you know, forms of agreements I've never even seen before that are so challenging to work through. You're just, you know, the restrictions they placed on you. Some investors will place so many restrictions that you have to go to them again for potentially another bad deal. So navigating that space is challenging. So if you have a really strong plan when you go into being a public company, especially if you can limit the cost, you limit the capital outlay for the first year. Once you get to that first year and you could be shelf eligible, you can be Rule 144 eligible, the universe changes a lot of it. And so, you know, maybe some of your listeners don't understand the Rule 144, but the SPAC is effectively a shelf company when you merge. The Rule 144 is a different way that brokers are allowed to trade your stock. So a lot of brokers don't want to take Rule 144 registration risk. The shares are registered by an S1. So that can affect liquidity, it can affect volume, the ability to raise capital. But manage that first year, and it's a new day a year later.
I love that you said that, because I feel like some people, they come out, they do the de-SPAC, all of a sudden it's like, you get a car. Everybody's just like, we're rich. And they just start blowing money instead of keeping that entrepreneurial spirit and staying locked in, staying lean. They're like, we're free from the shackles of private equity. Let's go. And like, and now they just end up spending frivolously and just throwing crap out there to see what sticks, instead of working the plan, executing the plan, being disciplined, being lean. Because to your point, if they don't operate that way, they can end up burning through cash faster than they ever thought was possible.
Yes. And the worst time to raise cash is when you need it.
Right. Yes. Okay. So let me ask you this, because we're talking about these things that are kind of axioms, right? Like what not to do, or if you're a private company going public. So let me ask, if you were advising another founder who's considering a SPAC, what would you tell them to watch out for structurally and maybe even psychologically? Because it's a mental game, right? It's challenging even psychologically for the strongest of us. So structurally and psychologically, what would you tell these founders to watch out for?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing on the psychological side is, you know, the high can't get too high on the highs, can't get too low on the lows. And there'll be so much volatility and you'll be watching your share price every day. But focus on the plan and what the purpose is of the company. And that's what's really important. And, you know, from a structural perspective is be prepared, you know, understanding what needs to happen next. Because once you're a public company, there's still so many things that have to happen in the short term. Be ready with that S1. I've seen companies take months to file that initial S1. And that is kind of a danger zone or insecure period of time as a public company and will limit their options on being able to raise money. You know, there's a lot of different forms of agreements that you have to worry about. You know, ELOCs are very popular, equity lines of credit, but not all ELOCs are the same. So understanding how the investor will trade your shares, how the counterparty makes money is really important. How the counterparty values warrants on their balance sheet is something no one ever explained to me as a private company, but became critically important. So be prepared, your strategic partners, your legal filings, and capitalization. And I think you could manage it through really well. Now, the IRPR part is really important as well. Being aggressive out there, attending the right conferences. You don't have to go to the mall, but the right one. And managing to, you know, have a thoughtful pipeline of press releases as well. You know, be communicating to the market, not changing your plan, just executing it.
I'm so glad you said that. Two things that if you didn't catch it, listeners, that he just said that are absolute gold right there. Number one is that if you're going to take public money, you've got to be public facing. If they can't see you, they don't know you. Your company is not all roses to where everybody's just clamoring and clawing all over the other person so that they can buy shares of your company, most likely. And so there's 6,400 companies competing against you to get the affections and dollars of investors. So you have to put yourself out there to give visibility and awareness for your brand. And then the other thing is really just, in my mind, you've got to have your mindset from a perspective of not getting on the highs and lows. You were talking about that, not getting there. In fact, there's a book I read not long ago, and I wish I could remember which one it was, but they talked about this guy is the CEO of a public company. He looks at his stock price once a week. That he's like, if I look at it more than once a week, my mind will start playing tricks on me and I'll be so consumed with what's happening with the stock price that I feel that I lose control of my own mind and I can't be confident to execute the way that I need to be able to. And so it's kind of like as a CEO, CFO, leaders are going to have to find their rhythm, their way of how they're going to pay attention to or selectively not pay attention to the stock price so that they can make sure that the price of a stock one day isn't determining what they do to execute. Because you talked about execution. You've got a strategy. You didn't just take the money because you wanted money. You came, that SPAC team worked with you because you have a plan to execute. And so work the strategy, work the system. And like, you've got these things that you're going to do. That's how you get your price up. Say, hey guys, in the next quarter, we're going to do this. And then come back 3 months later and be like, we did it. We told you we were going to, we went, we did it. So, and you just keep doing that. And they're like, holy crap, these guys just keep winning. They keep delivering. We love it. And that's how you get visibility and stock price up in a lot of different ways. So let me ask you this. There's a few different angles that I want to try to kind of weave in. I want to talk about managing redemption risk. And because there's that balance of retail and institutional shareholders that's there. And sometimes that can fall out of redemptions on one side. It can fall out of redemptions on the other side. And then there's also trying to keep both of them happy because they want different things. So could you talk about kind of how you feel some good ways are to help these companies manage redemption risk, and then talk about the idea of balancing that balancing act between retail and institutional shareholders. You're on mute, brother.
Sorry. Excuse me.
All good. All good.
Great question though. And you know, really important. And I think the first thing to realize is that the trust is the most efficient source of capital you can have as a recent de-SPAC company. So it is worth the effort, worth the time and resources to communicate with the trust, explain the plan, explain, you know, short-term milestones, and, you know, to limit redemptions. Now, we have to be honest. A lot of those trust investors are, you know, interest arbitrage plays, and their purpose is to invest in the trust. And that's fair. You know, that's their, you know, mode of business. But I think that you can find money in the trust, especially if there's short-term milestones that you can articulate a way for investors to safely redeem their money, even if it's not on the de-SPAC. So that's really important. And I think, you know, with other institutional investors, it's, you know, we're honestly recognizing where other institutional investors were coming. Institutional investors might not start investing right on the de-SPAC. If you're ahead of these large mega trends, there are those opportunities. Critical minerals can be one of those. Rare earths is really popular right now. But communicating with institutional investors, and like you said earlier, be consistent, execute your plan, tell them the plan, execute it, and told them you've done it. And they see this over a period of time, and I think it starts to garner some trust. So building that pipeline of institutional investors. And then there's even opportunities a year later to be included on certain ETFs or, you know, or other type of funds. So you can get this base of non-volatile shareholding. So thinking about it from a long-term perspective, and retail investors, you know, can be a blessing and a curse. So you got to be careful there as well. I think the right retail investors that believe in the story that can be long-term investors are great. And, you know, they'll tell their friends about it and they'll be excited to own your stock. Then there's a set of day traders that can be challenging because, you know, you release good news, your stock goes up and they might sell their entire position. So if you have a big chunk of day traders on your capitalization table, it can sometimes create limits to your growth. So the answer to that is communication with institutional investors, and you want to build that institutional investor base on your cap table.
100%. I agree. I'm sitting here just, I don't know if you've ever had Dr. Pepper creamy coconut. I've never had one before, but my daughter bought them yesterday. And so I'm having my very first one, and I'm sitting here looking at this can as you're talking about those day traders. And I'm just kind of thinking it's kind of like a Dr. Pepper creamy coconut. That it's insanely good for a moment, but then you just, you know, that at the end of the day, it's probably not the best results to have in your body.
There's a lot of advantages. We have some great retail investors and you know, we have some that will, call us up every week.
I like it. Okay. So let me ask you this. I want to know specifically from the lithium market. There's been a lot of volatility that's there. And obviously this doesn't have to be germane only to lithium. There's a lot of companies that get a lot of volatility. And so I'd love to know, from a standpoint of volatility post de-SPAC, is there any lessons that you've learned that we haven't already turned the stones over on?
Yeah. You know, one big lesson is there will be volatility, you know, as your cap table gets remade after the de-SPAC, investors will redeem or sell shares. New shareholders will come in that are interested in the story. And I think what's important is if you could make money on the way up and make money on the way down to leverage that volatility to capitalize the company. which means having the right structures in place is important, you know, before that happens, being ready to effectuate. You often see with the new DSPAC, you know, there's always a spike, always seems to be a spike in one day. Being ready for that, whether it's a type of synthetic ATM or an ELOC or an overnight pipe or an intraday pipe, having the right bankers set up or having the right ELOC set up to leverage those type of things. And the lithium market, it's really interesting because what you really got to understand about the lithium market is that the Chinese control of critical minerals is at the center of it. You know, they were able to, we believe, manipulate the price to stave off foreign competition. Prices skyrocket to 70,000. And then we see this compression by China over flooding the market. But their ability to do so has dramatically changed because, especially among other things, the rise of Chinese EV adoption. China is selling so many EVs now that they can't flood the market as easy in especially coming up. They'll need it to build their own EVs. And so their ability has changed. And that's why it's such a national security priority for us to onshore processing, which is why I know that even though our stock is, you know, can trade up, can trade down, can trade at a lower market capitalization, that what we're doing is very valuable. And as long as we continue the plan and execute it, our shareholders will be rewarded.
So, and I love that you kind of went back and brought it back to talking about Stardust Power, because I want to actually go there for just a moment. I want to just give you a moment to tell people a little bit more about Stardust, where you guys are headed, because you talked about telling people this is what we're going to do and then doing it. I want to just give you a second right now to tell people, what is Stardust going to do that you can say right now that they can watch you and that they can actually build trust by you executing on that?
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to discuss it. We all know that lithium is extremely important. You know, the world's economy is running on batteries. And as EV adoption is what it is, also for energy storage systems, for battery storage components on the back of data centers and AI, it's never been more important. America has got a lot of lithium resources, potentially the fourth largest reserves in the world. But we don't have this processing capacity. And that's how China is able to effectuate its stranglehold on the global supply chain by controlling processing. So at Stardust Power, what we're doing is we're building a really large, centrally located lithium refinery located in the heartland, right in Oklahoma, where we have a geographic advantage. Being the center of the country, we can source raw materials from anywhere. And what we're doing is optimizing this large central facility for multiple sources of lithium chloride input. So we could, you know, take 2,000 tons, 5,000 tons from different suppliers, limit our supplier risk, aggregate that supply and scale to 50,000 tons per annum of battery grade lithium carbonate when we're at nameplate capacity, which would more than triple the existing production we have in America today. So it's a huge piece of national infrastructure. It's never been more important. So what our plan was is we're going to get this ready. We're going to de-risk this project on our own balance sheet and then bring in our strategic partners. And so what I think the market has seen is, you know, we acquired our site. We bought it outright, 66 acres in Muskogee with an option on additional 40, a form of option. We've done all the due diligence to de-risk it, cultural, environmental. We've done all the front-end loaded engineering, culminating in our FEL-3 engineering study done by Primero USA. And that process is millions and millions of dollars in engineering study. We then took the extra step of an independent review, having a third party review our engineering to corroborate all of it. We then got it fully permitted, not only for construction, but for commissioning and ramp up, which is not required at this stage, but we wanted to show institutional investors that we can launch this facility. We put a team in place that can handle this execution, that is expert at construction and, you know, placement of that. We've brought in the right strategic partners. So we've invested over $10 million of our own balance sheet just to get the project to this shovel-ready type state. And now we're talking to institutional investors, strategic investors, and they're pretty impressed because everyone knows we need processing and a lot of drilling upstream, a lot of raw material investment is going on, but no new processing has come online. So now that we're here, you know, then we work every day on financing our asset, and then we can start the major construction process, a quick, call it 2 years, a little bit under 2 years to build it, and we can start producing battery-grade lithium carbonate in America.
I love it, man. I love it. And I will add to this, kind of as a closing thought on that, I think that a lot of people are underestimating how much lithium is going to be needed, because there is a new wave, I believe, that's about to hit our country and the world of draw down on lithium, which is humanoids. I believe that robotics, I see that people are going to be, in the next 5 years, you're going to start seeing people having humanoids in their home, more commonplace, big battery supplies. And as we continue to grow and grow and grow in our demand for robotics, it's just going to amp up the need for you guys even more. So let me ask a final question, and we're going to shut everything down here. For you, I'd love to know, would you rather have, you're going to get me so mad at me on this. if you were building an all-star team, would you rather have Chet, Holmgren, or would you rather have Wimby?
I mean, I love Chet Holmgren, and you know, I think he's going to continue to become a great player, an all-star, and an excellent performer. But I mean, Wemby is a once in a generational type. It's almost unfair. But the New York Knicks have figured out an answer for him. So, but you know, Wemby is pretty good,
dude. And just so the listeners know, if you're paying attention, Roshan is a legendary OKC Thunder fan. So it's just me giving him a little bit of a hard time, because he is not a fair weather fan. He's true blue and orange for those guys. And, even in the off season, he's showing them lots of love. So are you picking?
I will say, you know, I was born in New York, so I grew up a Knicks fan.
Are you picking the Knicks?
And then, you know, I was born in New York, but I grew up in Oklahoma. So my life dream is having the Thunder and the Knicks play in the finals. And last year we were close.
Almost.
This year we're even closer. So, you know, I'm sad my Thunder lost, but I'm really proud of my Knicks, and they're going to bring home the title this year.
So you pick a Knicks.
Oh, Knicks in five. Gentlemen,
Knicks in five. Okay. I'm watching. I love it, brother. Okay. Everybody, again, I'm here with Roshan from Stardust Power. Check out their company. They're doing, as if you can't tell already, some remarkable things. Roshan, I'm so grateful for you popping the hood, helping private companies looking at going public and considering a SPAC to do it. Hear about your story and some of the processes that you kind of learned the hard knocks on. So thank you so much for being a blessing and sharing that with our audience today. Thanks for being here, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chaz. And I really appreciate all the work you're doing for the ecosystem and getting the knowledge out there and being a trusted advisor to public and private companies. You know, I think that's such a service you're doing to the community. I really appreciate you having me on, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Appreciate you, brother. Everybody, again, my name is Chaz. I'm with Churchwell Insurance Agency, and I'm your host of the DSPAC podcast. Blessed to have Roshan here with Stardust Power today. Make sure that you subscribe on the homepage and do me a favor. Check out some of the YouTube. We got lots of edits that are about to be dropping here in the next week. You don't want to miss what's coming there. Blessings. We're out.